coming up on Simply Superior.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view.
Is that your ship coming in? And are you ready to take a plane yet? Our transportation expert tells us what's moving and what's not during the pandemic.
We still have crews sitting on cruise ships unable to get home.
Plus, being told to take a hike takes on a new meaning with a new book on the best Wisconsin trails.
In Wisconsin, when you're going up and down hills, you'll notice that it gets muddy sometimes if we've just had a rain in the last day or two. It's very easy for trails to wash out and wash away.
And our last words on the election in our regional news and review in visiting the ghosts of Fairlawn Mansion. Coming up next.
Truckin', got my chips cashed in. Keep truckin', like the dude of man. Together, more or less in line. Just keep truckin' on, on, on.
Welcome to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So, did you buy your plane ticket for that winter trip to Cancun? Or maybe reserve that cruise package with the day at Disney World? Or just thinking about taking a DTA bus over the bridge from Superior to Duluth? Or maybe none of those until somebody gives us the all clear on the pandemic, and I wouldn't bet on hearing that anytime soon. Here to talk about getting around, even in the relative safety of your own car, and also moving things around in trains and trucks, is Richard Stewart, Professor of Transportation and Logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and Director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. And can we say our resident transportation expert?
You certainly can say it, Robin, and it's a delight to be here. I want to start off by thanking all the transportation workers, that great hidden empire that nobody pays attention to unless they go to the grocery store and there's a stock out of products. or they go to some other location and unable to get what they need. These workers have been out throughout the entire pandemic, delivering cargo wherever it's needed, night and day. And they've done it very efficiently and very well. Mm-hmm. They're workers who are largely unrecognized, and I'd like to take a moment just to say thank you to all of them.
We'll join you with that. Thank you to those workers. So, switching gears a little bit, what's the latest on the can of worms interchange on I-35 in Duluth and, of course, leading in part to Superior, Wisconsin? I understand it'll be delayed.
The can of worms has been deferred. Some of the work on it, they're still doing test borings and trying to get more information on it. And they just passed a bonding issue, which has some funding for it, but not much.
On the Minnesota side.
On the Minnesota side. So I can't really give you a lot of information on where the can of worms is right now. I can tell you that this has been, and this has impacted also the can of worms area. This has been a tremendous year for the Port of Duluth in terms of wind generators coming in.
I've noticed. Well, and they're pretty hard not to notice.
Yes. In a typical year, you might see about 10 wind generator ships coming in. These are called heavy lift ships dropping off the wind generator parts. This year, they've had over 20.
Mm-hmm. So really, where are they going?
I'm not sure of all the locations that the wind generators are being transported to. I know there's more wind farms going up in Minnesota, Iowa, and the Dakotas.
Mm-hmm. So those windmill parts are coming off of our boats. And when we last spoke at the beginning of the pandemic, you were setting the record straight on the perception that cruise ships were petri dishes for the virus. And we haven't heard much about them, and we haven't heard anything about the virus affecting our ore boats or our shipping here. So what's an update on either of those?
Well, overall, the cargo movement on the Great Lakes by ship has declined compared to prior years, compared to a five-year average. And that's really due to a downturn in the manufacturing of steel. We move a tremendous amount of taconite. But even limestone movement, what we call aggregate, is also down compared to the five-year average. And coal has declined significantly. There have been no ship delays that I have heard about as a result of COVID. The companies are being very careful, and employees are being tested whenever necessary. And once you're off the ship, it's a common misbelief that you travel on merchant ships to see the world. Most of what you see is water, because whenever that ship is in port, you're busy trying to get it either loaded or unloaded as soon as possible. And with cell phones, there's no need to go ashore to make a phone call anymore. So many of these crew members get on the ship and 3 months later get off the ship and may not have stepped ashore during that entire time period.
So this is pure speculation, but they may be in a safer environment than the rest of us.
I can't answer.
I'm not saying go jump on a boat right now, but yeah.
Well, it is many ways a very much an isolated environment, and if you are isolated in a safe environment, you're going to remain safe.
Mm-hmm.
I've been rereading Hardy's book about the 1918 influenza, and they talked about how merchant ships spread that. We didn't have air transportation then, so it was only merchant ships. Spread the disease, and when the disease had entered a ship, half of them may be sick or dead by the time the ship arrived at the other location. So it can either be a very safe environment or very unsafe. And companies are taking a great deal of care to see that it's a safe environment.
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned the cruise ships. We still have crews sitting on cruise ships unable to get home.
Wow. Now, that's underreported.
That's one of the saddest things that I, you know, speaking as a former mariner, that I've ever heard of. And you have countries like the Bahamas, where the ships are flagged in, refusing to provide support for these mariners on their ships.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yes, you still have ships at anchor with crews still on them. And by the way, for the majority of these crew members, they are not being paid.
Hmm. I hope they're being fed.
Sitting there without pay in their berth, which is probably about the size of a prison cell, and being fed, but that's about it.
Mm-hmm. And they're from all over the world. They're usually not citizens of whatever country the ship is flagged to.
Yes, that's correct.
Well, that's sobering. Well,
one of the advantages in crewing your ship in Liberia or Panama or any of what we call the flag of convenience locations is you follow the labor laws of those countries and the tax laws of those countries, and you're usually able to hire crews from anywhere in the world to run those ships. That's not to say they're poorly run. I'm not implying that. That's the versatility that lies in the flag of convenience ship compared to having to follow OSHA rules or other things that you, or U.S. Coast Guard rules that you would on a American flagship, like the Great Lakes ships are. You instead are following the rules of the Liberian Coast Guard.
Mm-hmm.
So let me talk a little bit about some things I'm seeing happen, which are very positive indicators, by no means out of the woods yet. And I've just been reading about the 1918 Great Influenza epidemic, and it came in three waves, with the second wave even more severe than the first or the third. So I have to say I agree with the health experts that we're not out of the woods yet. But what I do see happening in terms of cargo is very positive. The U.S. Department of Commerce reported that September retail sales were at $549 billion plus, up 1.9% over August and up 5.4% annually. That's retail sales. That's what the consumers are buying at the stores. And typically that's moved by truck. We've seen the fourth consecutive month of expansion in factory activity. And once the factories start producing, then you start to see trucks and trains hauling the raw materials to feed the factories. right now there's the trucking industry is growing, but there's a shortage of truck drivers. Yes, of course, some truck drivers have fallen ill, just like the rest of the general population. But it's also becoming increasingly difficult to get truck drivers who are willing to put in the long, hard hours necessary to move cargo by truck. Pay has gone up for truck drivers. That's a positive that companies have across the board raised pay to try and get more truck drivers. But we're facing some hurdles in the fact that there's a generational gap. The average age of truck drivers is pushing into the 50s, and we aren't getting many of the young millennials and others to enter the field.
Mm-hmm. Is this a trend overall the last few years, or is this relevant to COVID?
COVID may have increased it slightly, but it's been a trend for the past decade.
Mm-hmm. And obviously people are getting sick. Nothing out of the ordinary for truck drivers? They are traveling.
They are traveling, and the companies are ensuring that they're taking safety protocols, masks, disinfecting, things like this for the trucks. One of the interesting aspects in trucking right now is the American consumer is pushing more and more for next-day delivery of goods. This changes trucking patterns, and warehouses start to be located closer to urban centers. You have companies like Amazon taking over the quintessential American mall, which is disappearing, and turning that space into an Amazon distribution center.
Right. Those warehouse workers, by the way, I would add them to the people you were lauding at the top of the show, who've been putting in extra hours to get us what we need. And air travel?
Well, actually, Robin, for the first time since March, TSA did the search on 1 million passengers in a day. So air travel is increasing. That's compared to October of last year with 2.6 million people moving. So we're still way below where we are, but we're seeing growth.
Mm-hmm.
Now, the other area that you're seeing growth is in air cargo. And we've seen a fairly substantial growth in air cargo. And some airlines, to keep the revenue streams going, have converted passenger planes to air cargo planes. You could do that by pulling out seats in certain models and moving more cargo in them to generate revenue.
That would make a lot of sense. You got the airplane, you probably have a mortgage on it.
Oh, yeah, you have a fair amount of what we call sunk costs, economic costs tied up in that airplane and all the parts and everything else that are sitting there. So any way that you could generate a positive return on investment, you want to do that.
Right. We're speaking with Richard Stewart, Professor of Transportation and Logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and Director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. Any predictions for the future?
Let me look at my crystal ball here that's all cloudy. From the pandemic point of view, I'm in no position to say whether there'll be a second wave, how big it'll be, or anything like this. But the experts in the field from CDC and others are all predicting the probability of this increasing. And when it does, we as a civilization will probably stay hunkered down. I'm calling you from my home and where the university has me working now, and I'm not by any means unique. So we'll be seeing that continue. And when you do that, I'm not driving on the highway. I'm not generating gas tax revenue for the states. I'm not using up my car in parts. All of that has an impact on the transportation sector.
Mm-hmm.
And I think we're going to see that continue, certainly through the end of the year and probably into the beginning, I would say, April and May of 21. It's possible by then there may be a approved vaccine through the CDC or someone else with authority to do so, and we may see a transition. When we see that transition, that people could get out, I think there's going to be a lot of pent-up desire to travel, And I saw this, I'm a little segue here. We went up into Boundary Waters three times this year, canoeing, and it was the busiest I've ever seen it in a decade. You're going to see groups of people who went to the Boundary Waters or up the North Shore or to the parks and other places because that was the only place they could get. But now that they could travel to New York or Cancun or wherever they're going to want to go, I think you'll see an explosion in the leisure travel industry.
Which could mean Cancun having the best August they've ever had, right?
Well, it's possible, but on the flip side, what I hear more and more is companies saying, you know, this working at home has some real benefits. Let's not build new office buildings. When you do that, your commuter transportation industry changes. But the whole working from home, talking to my daughter in Missoula, house prices are skyrocketing in Montana. And they're skyrocketing because people from L.A., urban areas, are saying, you know, I could live in Montana and do all this from home. I don't have to be in L.A. Now, what that may mean is less commuter driving, but you may see more jet travel as they go for the meetings.
I mean, of course, one jet travel per month makes up for all the commuter travel you were doing. Right.
Yeah, I know. Well, that
pollution.
We didn't talk environmental impacts, did we? No.
No. We could be here all day.
One of the aspects we haven't talked about, but you alluded to, Robin, is the fact that transit has taken a tremendous beating. People don't want to travel on subways, commuter trains, because of the fear of contracting the virus, and revenues for those systems are way below where they would typically be at this point.
Right. Plus, some of the systems that are built on, well, the whole idea is move a large number of people, aren't moving a large number of people.
And most of them are public services, so they're not sitting on large cash reserves like the airline industry is, the private airline industry, to allow them to carry through this unplanned-for disaster. So they're going to have to turn to our citizens and ask for revenue in order to keep them afloat in many cases. And voters will face some choices on this.
All right. Well, I was hoping to leave on a positive note with my dreams of my summer Cancun vacation or whatever. So.
Well, as I said, I think that barring a third wave that would occur, we will probably see some improvement. And as soon as we know that we could safely travel, I think we're going to see an explosion of travel.
Then I will stop right now and take that as the positive note. We've been speaking with Richard Stewart, Professor of Transportation and Logistics at the University of Wisconsin-Superior and Director of the Transportation and Logistics Research Center. Thank you for joining us.
A delight as always, Robin.
Coming up, Wisconsin's best autumn hikes after this.
What a long, strange trip it's been.
Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. So the next time someone tells you to take a hike, you can answer gladly, especially if you're outfitted with the latest book telling everything you need to know about the subject. It's called Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes, and it's the 27th book by Menominee native Rob Bignell. He spoke with my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Al Ross. Here's their conversation.
The 27th book, what have you learned about what people want, and has hiking changed?
Yeah, well, I don't think hiking has changed much at all, other than maybe the materials used to make equipment, you know, like trekking poles are no longer wooden. They're, you know, made out of special fibers and composites and so on. Mm-hmm. You know, hike is a hike. You get out in the woods and you just start walking. All my books up to this point have just been about regions. I wanted to do some more topical books. Just thought autumn leaves would be perfect.
Your list of the 10 best in Wisconsin includes some familiar names, places we all may have gone at some time. What's the difference between visiting a place like, let's use Holy Hill as an example, or one of the several state parks on your favorites list? What's the difference between visiting it and actually hiking it?
If So, you know, if you go to visit a place like, say, Holy Hill, you're looking at more of the spiritual experience of going into the Basilica.
Sure.
Whereas if you hike it, you're going down into the Ice Age Trail, which is below the hill itself. So if you're at Holy Hill, at the Basilica itself, looking down, you're probably looking at other things than nature or autumn leaves, though certainly you'll see the glory if you go up into the towers, because you're looking down at the valley where the Ice Age Trail runs. The beauty of hiking, though, is you're underneath the trees. You're in the canopy, and you come to vista points, so you can look up the hill and see the Basilica at the top. So a little different experience, because you're actually in the trees and under the canopy rather than looking at it from a vista.
The first chapter of your book, if you can call it a chapter, asks the question, why hike in autumn? Are the answers obvious, like the weather and the scenery, or are there other hidden gems there?
Sure, yeah. Well, the weather's the obvious advantage. It's much drier in autumn than it would be at any other time of the year. You lack the humidity usually in autumn. Mm-hmm. Temperatures are a little cooler, so you can probably go farther or go up a hill without breaking much of a sweat, comparatively to summer, for example. But the other advantage of hiking in fall is as the leaves change and begin to fall off, you get to see different things that you wouldn't see, say, during the summer. Leaves often are hiding rock formations around here that we have. So we have lots of sandstone formations and cuts and boulders that were left by the last ice age as well. And some of that gets hidden, so you get to see that. In addition, you get to see some different vistas, sight lines that you wouldn't see in summer as well because they're blocked off.
I like the fact that your guidebook also has suggestions, some of them possibly life-preserving in nature. Clothing, what to watch out for, that kind of stuff.
Right, yeah, absolutely. You should always layer your clothing whenever you go out hiking. You know, in summer, obviously, you probably can get away with wearing shorts and a T-shirt. But when it comes to fall, weather changes. It can change within a day. You have a nice sunny morning and it looks bright. Mm-hmm. Suddenly, it can get real cool in the afternoon, or you can even get rain. So I always recommend layering your clothing as much as you possibly can. A good pair of hiking boots is useful as well, because some of the terrain does get a little muddy at times, or can get rocky if you're attempting to climb up a hill or hike up a hill. We have lots of sandstone and limestone that breaks off easily.
The book is called Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes. It's one of many, produced by Rob Bignell. He's our guest, and we thank him for driving up a hill for better cell phone service. So, Rob, can people find themselves a little bit overconfident today? They're carrying a cell phone. People can come to depend on those for not only photographs, which are nice, but for GPS, and they,
right,
they have compasses on them. Are good old standbys like maps and compasses still a good idea?
Yeah, I always recommend you carry at least a paper map, and you probably should have a compass with you as well. You know, it's easy to drop your cell phone. It's easy to lose your cell phone. Yeah. And then what do you do at that point? Cell phones are great. GPS are awesome, obviously. Service to use, I use GPS. But there are times when you do get out in the remoter sections and you don't have any kind of service.
Yeah.
With my book, for all the featured trails, you can actually go online and print out an 8x11 map that shows you all the contour lines and has a little yellow line showing where the trail goes through. And then you don't have to worry about getting lost if you've got a map and you got a compass.
Yeah.
The side thing is, if you do get lost, the map is great for starting a little campfire to keep you warm at night.
Yes.
The map didn't do you any good anyway, right?
So, there you go.
But I'm only joking.
Sinking feeling to be out in the boonies, right, and look down at your phone and see it doesn't have a signal.
Absolutely.
I'll bet, yeah. I hope, Rob, it's just me, but because organizations have adopted highways and things, irresponsible folks seem to be littering a bit more than I remember in years past. You talk about leave no trace, which is a mantra that everyone should adhere to. It seems to be being replaced by, look, we ate at McDonald's. How are people doing leaving no trace?
Yeah, and it's not just litter, but general vandalism. You can look at it as vandalism. People spray paint on rocks, for example, carve their names and initials and so on into trees and even into the fire towers themselves. But anytime you spray paint or you toss litter out, What you're doing is you're ruining the experience for someone else. Mm-hmm. And it's just a simple matter of common courtesy. You don't want to see that when you go hiking. So if you don't do it and others don't do it, all of us will have a great experience when we're out there. It's really best not to bring that type of stuff out there anyway. You know, things like soda, for example, dehydrate you when you're out on the trail. It's much better just to bring water. It's best not to bring foods that are in plastic containers, because if you toss plastic out, other animals can ingest that or will chew on it or eat on it and so on. Mm-hmm. And when they do, of course, they get sick, potentially even die.
Of all the counsel you offer, it appears to me as if four words might be premier. Stay on the trail.
Right, yeah. Yep, toes on the trail, stay on the trail. Absolutely, yeah. In Wisconsin, when you're going up and down hills, you'll notice that it gets muddy sometimes if we've just had a rain in the last day or two. It's very easy for trails to wash out and wash away when there's nothing holding them down, when there's no grass or tree roots holding them down. So if you go off the trail, what you're basically doing is stomping on the low-lying plants and the grass, creating another trail, and that just creates more area for the trail to be washed out. And that just makes it difficult for the next hiker who's going up to be able to get to the top. It can even close trail sometimes if we get a heavy enough storm and washes it out. So contributing to that erosion effect may not seem significant in the short run, but in the long run, and especially if we have a good storm, the combined efforts of everybody going off the trail has a significant impact and effect.
It's his 27th hiking guidebook, Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes. Rob Bignell with us. You have several pages designated to trees and their fall costumes, and you have some cool things to do with leaves in the book.
Right, yeah. You know, I think when you take kids out on the trail, it's easy for some of them to get distracted. Some of them really just enjoy being out in nature and being excited by what they see. Whereas for others, it may not be the most exciting thing compared to the video game that you took them away from, or their cell phone that you took them away from when you went out there. So the idea is to keep kids involved and teach them a little bit about the environment, about the trail that they're on, so they can grow to appreciate it, and to keep them from getting bored and getting a little unruly. Now, the great thing, though, is even adults can play those games, and I know some adults who do. They go out and do the exact same thing that we recommend for the kids' games. That's lots of fun to do.
Yeah.
Great for a romantic date, for example.
Yep. So where can we get this book and all your books?
Sure. Yeah. Well, we're still lining up a number of bookstores that will provide it. I know we've got Valley Booksellers down in Baraboo has got copies coming in. Bookends on Maine and Menominee will have a copy or two. But in the rest of the state, you can just simply go online and it will be at Amazon.com. There's an ebook version, and then there's the paperback, which is in full color, and that version is available.
Rob Bignell, thanks. Appreciate it.
You bet, absolutely. Thanks, Al.
The latest in the Bignell sequence of books to help us enjoy life, Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes. Enjoy it and enjoy getting out.
That was WPR's Al Ross speaking with Menominee native Rob Bignell, author of Wisconsin's Best Autumn Hikes. Coming up, the regional news and review in Fairlawn by Flashlight after this. Welcome back to Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington, and I'm joined by Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Hello, Brooks.
Hey, Robin.
And our Superior-based reporter for Wisconsin Public Radio, Danielle Kading. Hi, Danny.
Hi, Robin.
So this is it. This is our last show before Election Day. Of course, it's been election season, and voting has been going on. And before we talk about all that, let's go back to transportation. Brooks, in Duluth, Superior Street has got some construction going on.
Yeah, and we'll continue to have stuff going on as the big news this week, as we reported that Superior Street reconstruction in downtown Duluth will enter a fourth year of rebuilding after weather prevented crews from finishing laying a permanent surface on parts of the street. So if you're downtown Duluth, west of Lake Avenue, parts of that street will be covered in asphalt temporarily this winter as the road reopens sometime in November. And then next year there will be partial closures once again as a permanent surface is put down. The $31.5 million project was supposed to wrap up this year, but sometimes you just get to blame the weather for delays.
Well, I think the goal is to make it a truly superior street, right?
That's right.
All right. And also in Duluth, Spirit Mountain, it's feeling the spirit too, if I may make bad puns.
Yeah, after being closed since March due to the pandemic and they did not have a summer season, they decided to save up for a winter. They've got a new interim executive director, and I talked with her this week, Ann Glumak, who is optimistic for a strong season, as is the board chair of the public ski hill over on the west side of Duluth. So far, season pass sales are a little behind last year, but with a price increase coming up, they're expecting that to catch up, if not surpass, earlier levels. With all the interest this summer and spring in outdoor recreation, folks getting out to trails, parks, campgrounds, many for the first time, there's hope that that'll carry over into winter sports like skiing, snowboarding, cross-country skiing, and Spirit Mountain will see a much-needed rebound in traffic as the mountain continues to face financial difficulties, and it is undergoing a deep study of its impact economically on Duluth and just how much Duluth taxpayers should continue to support it.
Okay. Well, going to the Superior side, or should we say the Canadian side, big changes for Husky, the company. Danny?
Yeah, the rival Canadian oil and gas company announced this week that it's agreed to buy Husky Energy in a $2.9 billion deal. That announcement came on Sunday, and it comes as Husky is reporting more than $5 billion in losses over the last 3 months. And that's because the oil industry has been hit hard by the coronavirus pandemic as fuel demand has declined across the world. And Reuters is reporting that Cenovus, the company that will be buying Husky, will cut up to a quarter of its workforce, or around 2,100 jobs among the two companies. And Husky has said that most of those reductions will take place in Canada, but right now it's unclear when those cuts would be made. And in the meantime, the Superior Refinery rebuild is still moving ahead despite all these changes, and that's expected to be largely covered by insurance.
So good news for the people who would be working on that.
Absolutely, and I think any good news is very welcome at this time.
Right. Well, good news for homeowners in Superior. Our continuing story of BNSF and the taconite dust housing home repair credits.
Yeah, BNSF Railway said this week that it will resume payments to homeowners seeking reimbursement for cleaning up taconite dust that comes from its taconite facility. Superior City Councilor Jenny Van Sickle first made that announcement on Tuesday, saying that the company plans to resume payments within a half mile of its facility, or to homeowners within a half mile of its facility. And a company spokesperson said that those details are still being finalized. They intend to compensate everyone that's affected, although Van Sickle has said that not everyone would be reimbursed who had been in the past, but that it's a step forward with the company, which had stopped paying some of those claims back in July. And typically, she has said that around 200 homeowners receive those payments each year, of somewhere between $200 to $500 to clean dust off of their homes.
Mm-hmm. Well, as I said earlier, this is the last show before the election, or election day, since voting has been going on. Brooks, we're getting no end of attention to our area.
That's right. Vice President Mike Pence was up in Hibbing on Monday, and I was there to watch him draw a stark contrast between the Trump administration and Democrat Joe Biden. It was the fourth visit by the administration, two from Pence and two from Trump, to northern Minnesota during this election cycle, just this in the past few months. It was a cold visit, and Pence was out there just a few days after his aides tested positive for COVID-19, although the vice president himself had tested negative. The event itself was attended by about 650 people, which was well above the state's limit of 250 for even outdoor rallies. Pence spent most of his speech on the economy and jobs and promises of a new age of prosperity on the Iron Range, but he spent little time addressing the pandemic, as new cases have surged in Minnesota and Wisconsin. And despite the outbreak among his own staff, Pence has vowed to continue his campaign schedule.
And of course, their hope is to flip Minnesota, which went narrowly for Hillary Clinton. But the numbers aren't looking so promising for the Trump camp. Of course, the numbers weren't looking promising 4 years ago either. You are looking at some in Wisconsin?
I have seen a few polls on both sides of the border, and, you know, according to the Cook Political Report, Minnesota and Wisconsin both remain lean Democratic, which at this point in the race, with, you know, early voting coming in and questions about ballots being counted after Election Day, although I suppose in Wisconsin that question has been settled, in Minnesota it remains unsettled. It's certainly not toss-up territory, but it seems it is going to be a close one.
Danny, what have you been seeing?
Well, here in Wisconsin, Democratic presidential nominee Joe Biden is leading President Donald Trump by 5 points among likely voters, and that's according to the latest Marquette University Law School poll. 48% of voters surveyed say they support Biden, while 43% support Trump. 2% say they plan to vote for the Libertarian candidate, Joe Jorgensen. But 8% said they are still undecided. And that's significant because we saw in 2016 that Hillary Clinton was leading in the polls. In the final Marquette poll before the 2016 election, the polls showed Clinton ahead of Trump by 6 points. And now we know that many voters were undecided through their support behind Trump. And, you know, since Wisconsin is a battleground state, candidates are making last-minute stops here to win over voters. And President Donald Trump was in La Crosse on Tuesday and is expected to stump in Green Bay today. Former Vice President Joe Biden, he's also expected to be in the state today for his third visit to the Badger State. And all of this comes as Governor Tony Evers is urging people to stay home as the state has set new daily records this week for coronavirus cases and deaths. And that is also happening as the state's Supreme Court announced on Wednesday that it would hear a challenge to the state's mask mandate.
All right. So to put the final punctuation mark on this election season, I'm going to ask each of you, without giving an opinion, one word that sums it up for you. We're going to go with you first, Brooks.
Fascinating.
That's a good one. Danny?
Chaotic.
And I'm going to add to that scary, because it's going to lead into our final piece. But before we do that, I want to tell you we've been talking to Brooks Johnson of the Star Tribune's North Report team. Thank you, Brooks.
Thanks, Robin.
You can read the stories by Brooks and the Star Tribune's entire Twin Ports Bureau at www.startribune.com/northreport, and be sure to subscribe to their local newsletter. And we've also been joined by my Wisconsin Public Radio colleague, Danielle Kading, the Superior-based reporter for WPR News. Thank you, Danny.
Thanks, Robin.
So what's really scary? As Danny just reported, the governor is urging Wisconsin residents to stay home. But not an endorsement one way or the other. If you must venture out for Halloween or before, the folks at Superior's Fairlawn Mansion are opening up their home. It's their Ghost of Fairlawn flashlight tour, and it's been going on Halloween and Friday the 13th for quite a few years. Danny spoke a few years back with former staffer Stacy Buchanan.
Fairlawn Mansion was built in the 1890s. By Martin and Grace Pattison. He was a lumber baron and a mining baron in the area. He was originally from Ontario, but he used money that he got from land prospecting in northern Minnesota, and he discovered iron ore, and that's really where he made his big money. And he had built Fairlawn after he became mayor of Superior. And so it's kind of just an iconic piece for Superior. I think when people come to Superior, that's what they think of. But they lived in the house up until about 1920. Martin passed away in 1918, and his wife moved out to California, but then she donated the house to be used as a children's home. And so it was used as a children's home from 1920 to 1962. And then after a few years after the children's home was closed, they decided to use it as a museum in Superior. So that's basically the brief history.
Okay. So there's been a lot of people coming and going over the years through that house.
A lot. Besides the family, with the children's home, we've had an estimated about 2,000 children come through the house, which out of the 42 years is quite a bit.
Wow. And, you know, the fact that it was a children's home, I mean, was it like an orphanage or?
We usually talk about it more as what you'd think of as foster care today. Not necessarily orphans. You would have had a few come through, but most of them would have been what we think of as foster care kids.
And so every year you put on these flashlight tours during the Halloween season.
Yeah.
And so can you kind of describe how that goes then?
We do the flashlight tours just before Halloween for a couple of days, and then we do them Friday the 13th throughout the year. So wherever Friday the 13th falls, we also do the flashlight tours. But what we do is we talk about the superstitions of life in the Victorian era. So tour guides, you know, it's away from their regular tour, and they get to talk about those different superstitions, be it, you know, marriage or death, ghosts, fairies. There's a couple of different topics that they can pull from that they talk about on their tour. So a little bit different from the regular tour, just giving the history and showing the house. But you do get to go through the house in the dark. So that's kind of the best part.
So what are some of the superstitions then that you talk about on the tour?
Like I said, it really depends on the tour guide on what they choose to talk about. When I was doing flashlight tours, probably my favorite topic to talk about was death during that time. First of all, they didn't have funeral homes like we think of now. So most of the funerals would have taken place in the home itself. And so different superstitions they had with death, like mirrors, you had to cover up the mirrors so you wouldn't get possessed, how funerals would have taken place in a home such as Fairlawn. Some of the dress, like we think of, you know, you have to wear darker clothing, but actually they had very specific directions for whoever the family member was related to. So if it was the widow, they had specific things that they needed to have. If it was a son or a daughter, they needed to have specific dress. They had issues with the clocks. They always stopped all of the clocks at the time of death. But they did think that you could get possessed very easily or be taken with them to death if you weren't careful.
Yeah. Well, why did they think that at that time?
We don't know. Victorians is probably one of the most superstitious, I want to say, time era. They took a lot of what they learned from, like, medieval times, and then, you know, had these superstitions about it. They replicated many things. It's very difficult to find artifacts. You know, if you have somebody brings in a certain artifact, sometimes it's very difficult to tell between medieval and a Victorian copy. So they were just obsessed with it. It was just the thing that they did. So.
And so were there any types of these funerals held at Fairlawn Mansion?
Martin Pattison did pass away in 1918, so he would have had a funeral at that time, and that would have been taken place at Fairlawn, just as anybody who would have passed away in their own home, that's how it would have been done.
And did he pass away in the home?
He did pass away in the home. He died in his late 70s, they do believe of diabetes issues, but in his sleep, about the best way I guess you could go.
And so you've worked in this house for 13 years.
Yeah.
And so I'm just thinking about you being there alone at night, maybe closing things up in his room. Any stories about that?
I do not personally have any stories. I have worked there for 13 years, but I have never come across anything. There are many stories out there, and we do touch on a couple of the biggest ones during the flashlight tours. And we put it out there that we let you believe what you want to believe, but we're not going to... Most of us haven't had issues throughout the home at night or even in the dark. It's been pretty peaceful, but that doesn't mean that people haven't had their stories come about.
Right. I've heard some rumors from people I used to know that were either attending school at UWS and then working there part-time. And so what are some of the things that people have said over the past of they might have experienced?
I would have to say probably the biggest stories would be... from staff members hearing children's laughter or like playing near the pool in the basement. There was a story well out on the internet for many years that talks about two kids who would have drowned in the pool during the children's home. We don't know that they would have had the pool during the children's home. I mean, they had financial issues with food and taking care of the kids, let alone to, you know, fill a pool and be able to have kids being able to use it. So hard to say, but that's probably one of the biggest ones. One of the other big stories that are out on the internet that's been out for years is that there's a servant who passed away suspiciously after she had left and married, after she left Fairlawn, and she came back to Fairlawn because it was the place that she was comfortable and felt welcome. And so she is spotted in many areas of the house, either helping people, helping tour guides when they get lost or anything like that.
Lending a helping hand from beyond.
Yes.
Well, that's really interesting. And so this is all stuff that you've heard from people that you've worked with, or have you heard it too from people who take the tour?
Most of it is usually on the internet. I was gonna say I've had a few tour guides who have had experiences. One specifically, they never found the ones that usually have the stories, that they're very kind ghosts or spirits throughout the house. They're never really angry. They're not provoked of any kind. That's usually kind of the theme across the board from those who have had experiences.
Are there any areas of the house that are off limits to the tour?
We do not go in the attic as well as the basement for safety. It's just those are very deteriorated areas and it's difficult to get into, especially with larger groups and tours. So we do not take those even on regular tours.
You said the basement was where the pool was?
The basement is where the pool was.
Why would they build a pool in the basement?
Who wouldn't want a pool? they actually also had a bowling alley down in the basement as well. And so they did use most of it for storage. They had kind of a laundry area and whatnot. Their major ice box when they first built the house. But they had a nice little area for a 6-pin bowling alley as well as the pool. And the pool is still there. They drained it with the children's home. They filled it, flattened it out, and we use it. They've used it for storage for many years. So.
Okay. And you talk about how, you know, the rumors that exist, the ghosts are, or spirits that may or may not be present are mm-hmm. kind. And mm-hmm. so I'm just kind of wondering, can you tell us what kind of people the Pattersons were?
The Pattersons were very philanthropic. Martin originally came from Ontario. His name was actually born Simeon Martin Thayer. He ended up in Lower Michigan for a while. He actually was a state legislator at one point for Michigan, and he had a family and two kids. He left his family. They did not know at the time where they had gone. At that point, he ended up in Upper Michigan and actually met his second wife. So he never divorced the first one. And so there's actually quite a little bit of a scandal with that. But when he came to the Superior Duluth, you know, the Twin Port area, he was your everyday person. He didn't have a lot of money. You know, him and his wife came here. They had a couple of kids. And that is when he started to do the land prospecting. That's where his expertise was. He ended up lumbering at Pattison State Park, which is south of here. And then
named for him.
Yep. Actually, it was named for his wife.
Okay.
Not for him. Yep. He donated it to the state in his wife's name. But when he discovered the iron ore and ended up with money, he was already mayor. He was starting to get back into the politics in this area. But they did have a lot of philanthropic ties, specifically his wife with the Superior Children's Home and Refuge Association. So that's probably the biggest one that we talk about because, of course, it did end up leading to her donating the house to be used as a children's home. I mean, most people wouldn't donate their house after they leave to a cause like that. There was a need, and so that's what she had done. When he passed away, he specifically had it so that the land around the state park was donated in his wife's name.
Well, it sounds like they did a lot for the community and that they mm-hmm. came here in part to start over.
And actually when he was running for his third term, he was the second, third, and sixth mayor of Superior. So it would have been when that sixth term before that started, the scandal actually did come about into the Superior papers. His first wife finally did find where he had gone. He chose Pattison as his last name because it was his mother's maiden name. So it was another family name. And surprisingly enough, you know, they bring out this huge scandal while he's running for mayor and everybody still voted him in. And so, I mean, most of them probably were like, well, things happen. You know, he was very well known in the area and he was a good guy. So, but he was a part of a couple of different organizations, Masons, Oddfellow, Elks, did a lot within the community.
And the first wife, did she have a few choice words to say?
There isn't a whole lot written down.
Okay.
So we don't know what conversations took place. We don't even know that he necessarily denied the story, but we do know that she left with a chunk of money at that time and left back home.
I guess that can solve any kind of relationship problem. So, well, what else would you like people to know about the flashlight tours?
Gosh, they're fun. We do try to do them every half hour, if not earlier. So trying to get towards that 20 minutes almost, just to get people through as quick as we possibly can. We do have the staff available to do that. And we do ask that you bring your own flashlight. We only have so many available if people do forget.
Mm-hmm. The tour itself takes about 20 minutes?
No, they actually usually take about 40, 45 minutes.
Okay.
But we do try to run them every half hour to 20 minutes, depending on how quickly we can get people through.
Okay. And bring extra batteries. You don't want to be caught in the dark.
No. It is very creepy in the dark, but I feel like any old house is creepy in the dark.
Any house can make weird noises.
Yes, and she does creak often, that's for sure. We do not recommend it for kids 5 and under. I have had a few people who, kids who are into that kind of thing, come along and they've enjoyed it as well. But it's usually for a very unique child under 5 that will work with.
Well, I really appreciate you taking time to come and talk about it.
Thank you so much for
giving us a little bit about the history of the mansion.
Thank you for having me.
That was former Superior Museum staffer Stacy Buchanan speaking with Danielle Kading a few years back. And this year, the mansion is indeed holding its Ghost of Fairlawn flashlight tour tonight, October 30th at 6 p.m., with, I'm told, barely a space left as of yesterday. There will be social distancing, masks required, and hand sanitizer in plentiful supply throughout the mansion. It's highly popular, so be sure to check online first at superiorpublicmuseums.org/Fairlawn Mansion. Again, superiorpublicmuseums.org/Fairlawn Mansion. And if tonight is sold out, the tour returns 2 weeks from today on November 13th and every Friday the 13th going forward, including, at some point, the end of the pandemic. Next week on Simply Superior.
Ow!
Are you still telling scary wolf stories?
Hey there, Little Red Riding Hood.
That might be fine for Mother Goose, but for the true life tale of how wolves survive and interact with their environment, look to Isle Royale. Pioneering wolf researcher David Meech joins us to discuss Wolf Island, his just-released memoir of his days studying the canines on the island that he calls nature's perfect laboratory, and how it led to his lifelong career. That's it for this edition of Simply Superior. I'm Robin Washington. Stay safe, everyone.
Simply Superior, news and issues from a superior point of view. Gathered to mirror your life and interests with the goal of helping you.